KPFT Houston.
It's time to holler down the pipe, Chase, and rattle them bars, because fixing to bring a prison show to you right here from beautiful old, historic old KPFT Houston. That's the Mighty 90.1 FM frequency voice of Pacifica Foundation in the upper Texas Gulf Coast. It's Friday Night Out with Ray Hill and the Prison Show Gang. Miss Marta's mattering an old wet hen at the governor about something he did or something he didn't do, and while she's at it, she'll probably take a swipe at half the wardens. She lost her husband to Louisiana's death row, and since then, she only sees two colors, inmate white and guard gray, and as she sees it, only white is bright. Dewey's out there turning the knobs and flipping the switches, trying to make us sound good, which ain't always easy, given my erratic mic technique. Ann has driven all the way down from Huntsville, because since she quit the system as a nurse and married her convict husband by proxy, right here on the prison show, this is as close as she can get to visit him. I'm Ray Hill. And for the last 25 years, I've started my radio program with those words. My staff and I proceed to discuss politics of prisoners and their families. We discuss cops, courts, jails, prisons, probation and parole, all the other minutiae of the criminal justice industry. We do that for an hour. Then I answer the telephone on the air for another hour or two, while wives, mothers, and children, occasionally fathers, brothers, sons, and lovers call, because in Texas, inmates are not allowed to use the telephone. It's mostly women's and children's voices that give a few words of encouragement and love to the convicts in my audience, who are desperately hoping to hear a familiar voice on the radio. Some folks call it a therapeutic community, but it's really an eavesdropper show. I'm talking to the convicts, and the callers are talking to the convicts, but the listening audience get to hear the ethos and the pathos of poor people's lives as they try to survive when their major breadwinner, beloved son or father, is in prison. I know what this is all about, because I was sentenced to 160 years, that's 20 consecutive 8-year sentences in Texas prisons, and I got out in 4 years, 4 months, and 17 days. Of all the things I have done in my life, Bible-thumping teenage evangelist, fraudulent college professor, activist for lost causes, my mother, Frankie, was proudest of the prison show. Proud that I could give others what we had, a sense of intimacy, belonging, and love and support when you're far away from your family. But Frankie and I were always close, no matter what happened. What they say about gay men and their mothers is certainly true of Frankie and me. We were more like sisters than mother and son. I came out of the closet when Eisenhower was president. Frankie, my father, and my father Raymond, had been worried about me. They noticed that I tended to dress up in coats and ties more than the other boys in the neighborhood, and they thought I was trying to appear to be wealthier than we were. But when I told her I was gay, she was relieved. She said, "Thank God, Ray, we thought you were growing up to be a Republican and would embarrass the family." While I was in prison, Frankie visited me as often as they would allow. It didn't matter how rickety the old car was or how slick the tires or even how scarce the money in her purse. If it was visiting day, she was there to see my son, pronounced in all capital letters. Instead of being ashamed of my going to prison, she was proud that I survived. Without Frankie, I may not have made it out at all. I went to prison for real crimes. I was a burglar. I didn't break into people's houses and steal their cutlery. There's no money in cutlery. I broke into their warehouses and stole their capital assets. And I stole stuff queers know something about, antiques, art, jewels, and electronics. I thought I was Robin Hood, you understand, steal from the rich and give to the worthy poor myself, of course. The money was good. The hours were different. Burglars work when no one else is around. And the only thing bad about the profession is the retirement plan. The Houston Chronicle gave me great headlines. $4 million burglary ring busted. Leader refuses to identify co-conspirators. So by the time I actually got to prison, where all they do is read about crime in the newspaper, I was their hero. And I refused to rat on the others involved, so I was not just a hero to the convicts, but to the guards as well. Prisons do not constitute two societies, one for the keepers and another for the kept. Prisons are one society, including guards and convicts. They think alike, share the same value system, speak the same rough language. They may have different roles, but there's only one culture inside. I was busted in San Diego, California in the summer after a crime spree that went from New Orleans, Louisiana, across Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, Nevada, and Southern California. All of my offenses were nonviolent crimes against property, but the former owners of that property valued it enough to want to see me prosecuted and punished for taking it. That seemed reasonable even to me. I first went to San Diego City Jail. Now, City Jail is where you go. If this place got raided tonight, we would all go to City Jail, and most likely we would get out in the morning. County Jail is where you stay, at least until you make bond or get tried and let go or sent to prison. Prison is where you live. Bam! That first door that slams behind you on your way to a real prison sentence will echo through your life like a report from a cannon. Sometimes when I'm really quiet or just waking up from a deep sleep, I can hear that door in San Diego City Jail slam behind me. When you're in jail, and they're not going to let you go for a long time, the only escape available to you is sleep. So I did that. The next morning, the first sound I was able to isolate over the general din was squeak, 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 squeak. The sound of an unlubricated wheel on a metal cart bringing breakfast to city jail cells. You can't see it coming because there is no panoramic view from a jail cell. You can only see what is in front of the cell. In addition to the squeak, squeak sound, I could smell the faint odor of weak coffee and even more subtle odor of oatmeal. When I saw him, it seemed that he had been doing that very same thing since Roman times. He was an old trustee whose station in life was to push that cart and feed those waiting inmates their breakfast. He had no expression, only great purpose in his work. There on the cart was a stack of 10 cups, one of which he filled with weak coffee and put on the floor and pushed under my cell door with the coffee-stained toe of his work boot. Then he took one of the metal plates from the stack, put two pieces of bread on it, and held them in place by putting his thumb through them. With his free hand, he stirred the oatmeal with a large spoon and dabbed a scoop on the plate. There was a problem. Bars are vertical. Plates of oatmeal are horizontal. He did not put the plate on the floor and push it in with his toe. He simply turned the plate sideways, stuck it through the bars, and turned it back up before the oatmeal spilled a drop. The oatmeal was of such consistency and his movement so deft that the whole operation was successful. Since Roman times, see what I mean? I was soon transferred to San Diego City Jail, where I would stay while the government prepared their case against me. Since I had an interstate trail of crime behind me, there was the possibility of federal charges, interstate transportation of stolen goods, interstate flight from justice, and so on. So that resulted in frequent visits from a young, good-looking FBI agent. Man in black, wider lapels, and thinner ties than now, of course, but you get the idea. Frankie had taught me a few things about talking to cops, and the first of those things was, don't. So I didn't. He became increasingly frustrated by this, but I thought he was a little more attractive and vulnerable when he got mad. One day he rushed all the way to my cell and he thrust a teletype through the bars and demanded that I read it. It said, "The federal government of the United States of America is not interested in prosecuting Raymond Wayne Hill, birth date, social security number, for anything, space, space, signed." It wasn't really signed, but S-I-G-N-E-D was typed in there, then two more spaces and the initial J. "What do you think of that?" he demanded. "Well, actually, I think this is very good news, if it's true," I responded. "Do you know the director?" "The director of what?" I asked. "The director of the FBI." "J. Edgar Hoover?" "No one knows J. Edgar Hoover. He's a mythological figure who rules the world by fear and intimidation. Of course I don't know J. Edgar Hoover. What's that got to do with this teletype?" "In our system, only the director can sign an order that way." "Do you know anything about the director?" Another thing Frankie taught me about answering questions put to me by a cop is to listen very carefully to the question and answer only that question. The question was, "Do you know anything about the director?" The question was not, "Have you heard any rumors? Is there any gossip on the streets or in the gay community?" So the correct and truthful answer to the question was, "No, I don't know anything about the director." What I did know was that in the D.C. gay community, word was Hoover was gay. After he died, his biographers reported, he occasionally dressed in drag and received his house guests as Mary. I once happened to have heard Ethel Merman tell a television interviewer, "I used to go to the Triple Crown races every year with J. Edgar Hoover and his companion Clyde Tolson. They were such a lovely couple." He left all of his worldly goods to Clyde, and I've often wondered what happened to that Merman interview. But his files were later destroyed by those in power who had ample reason to fear their content. I do not know why J. Edgar Hoover interceded in my case. It's certainly a mystery and a great disappointment to his young, good-looking agent who felt he had several airtight cases against me. Since then, I've thought that perhaps some of my gay friends who happened to be higher-ups at Tulane University might have known Hoover and somehow intervened on my behalf. But at the time the telex arrived, I was just grateful and cared not how my salvation came. After the passage of several months, the relatively minor cases in Louisiana, New Mexico, and Nevada just dried up. Arizona decided that I wasn't worth the extraditing, which left Texas and California. Anxious to get me off the taxpayer dole, California agreed to a misdemeanor plea solution to my cases and informed Texas they had 90 days before I was to be cut loose. The days dwindled down to less than 30 before my eagerly awaited release. Then the little man from Texas showed up. He walked in with a swagger, sported a big cowboy boots, a big hat, a western cut sport coat, and a belt buckle so big you could cook breakfast in it. "I'm a deputy sheriff from Harris County, Texas, and I'm here to pick up a fugitive and take him back to stand trial." He put handcuffs and leg irons on me. Then he put a wide leather belt around my waist with rings both front and back. There had to be chains from the handcuffs to the leg irons through the rings front and back. I looked like a reject from a Marquis de Sade nightmare. He roughly escorted me to the waiting, unmarked Ford police car and puts me in the back seat. I noticed there were no inside handles on those rear doors. Off we went, squealing tires, jumping in front of traffic, taking the right away by force. He drove around the block, and once we were out of sight of San Diego County Jail, he stopped, got out, and told me to get out as well. No easy task with all those chains. We were in an unsecured parking lot, yet he began taking all of that stuff off of me.
You waived extradition, didn't you?
Yes, sir.
You know you're going back to Texas to stand trial.
Yes, sir.
You're Raymond Hill's son, ain't you?
Yes, sir. My father, Raymond, was a minor East Harris County public servant. He controlled 4 or 5 voting precincts and served on water boards and the like.
Well, I'm a little hungover, and I'm going to have to let you drive. You know how to get back to Texas?
Yes, sir. You go up here to U.S. 90 and head east, and it'll take you right there.
Stop in Tucson. I'll put you up in Comanche County Jail there and get some rest.
Yes, sir, I replied as he lay down in the back seat, you know, the one without any door handles, and promptly went to sleep. I stopped outside of Tucson, woke him up, and we ate, and he put handcuffs on me, locked me in the back seat, and we drove to the county jail and parked inside the Sallyport. A Sallyport is a secure area where vehicles park while discharging their arrested passengers. Exactly who Sally was and why this device bears her name is as yet unknown to me. The same areas are called the back gate in prison. He got out and put on his hat and swaggered up to the deputy sheriff in the Sallyport.
I'm a deputy sheriff from Texas, and I got a fugitive in custody, and I need a place to hold him till morning so I can get me some rest.
Not in this jail, you don't. The last fugitive you left here, we kept for 3 days while you pulled a big drunk, had trouble with the city police, and you've not paid us for that one, and you're not leaving another one here until you pay your outstanding bill and pay in advance for this one.
What does it cost?
$40 a night.
Hell, I can put him up at the Holiday Inn for that kind of money.
We suggest you do that, but you're not leaving him here until after you pay. He got back in the car, called him cheap-ass mothers. Well, considering the tender ears and the radio rules, and how rough language is used by prisoners and guards and cops, there are times when I will say the word mother, which is the first half of a longer word. You'll just have to fill in the blank with your imagination. So we got back in the car and, of course, shared the driving until we got to El Paso, which is a Texas jail. And since I was a Texas funeral, they were going to have to hold me for no fee. The little man from Texas went on to become very famous. Marvin Zindler was the wig-wearing newsman who broke the real-life story that became the musical Best Little Whorehouse in Texas. He's still on television to this day, doing the news. You can see him in his wig every night right on Channel 13 in Houston. When I finally did get back to Houston, I was placed in Harris County booking tank. There were several of us there, and everyone, including me, was a little scared. Well, actually a lot scared. When the deputies would ask us questions, we would nervously and quickly answer, all except this older guy sitting on the floor leaning back against the wall.
What's your name? The guard barked at him.
It's the same as it was the last time I was in here. I think that was last week, wasn't it? You were here. You booked me. I'm still Red Alexander, if you can't remember nothing.
Where do you live?
Here, mostly.
What's your occupation?
I'm a thief. That's what I'm doing here. I steal stuff and get busted, and they bring me to jail. I'll be out in the morning. My lawyer will spring me as soon as you let me use that phone.
He wasn't afraid. The rest of us were. I thought it might be a good idea to learn something about how to do time by asking his advice. I eased up beside him, and I said, Mr. Alexander, my name's Red. Red, I'm expecting to do some time on this case, and I'm scared. Could you give me some pointers on how to handle all this? Boy, he was full of advice and freely talked all night and every time our paths crossed, which proved to be often. He would get out, as he said, but in a few days he would be back.
Red's advice, it was priceless.
Don't ever trust any mother that lets herself be called any kind of name of a varmint. You'll run into a lot of spiders and snakes and wolves and eagles and other kind of varmint nicknames in this joint. Don't trust any of them. They all crap sorry.
Well, where do you find wisdom like that? He was full of information.
Homosexuals? I'll tell you what makes a homosexual. You see, old lady's big and pregnant, and the old man can't wait any longer for a piece, so he knocks it off and a little, and the sperm goes through them tubes and gets in the baby's mouth. Right there, you got yourself homosexual.
You can see his perspective on things was not readily available from other sources.
Well, if that explains male homosexuals, what about lesbian? Ain't no such thing. All there is to a lesbian is a woman that no man has put it to her right. If a man would put it to her right, she'd no longer be a nasty lesbian. I can do the same things to any woman that a lesbian can do, and I do it better.
Well, some of his wisdom was more colorful than reliable, but still, he provided some useful advice that helped me do time a little easier. In prison society, that's how things are learned. Older convicts guide younger ones, as in any society. Much is made of protecting younger inmates from the older ones. When they actually try to do that, it upsets the pecking order, and the young inmates destroy one another in testosterone wars. Men do not know from popular knowledge in the free world how to adapt and survive in prisons. They learn those things from the only source available, older members of that society. Do they get exploited in the process? Exploitation of the young by the old is not exclusive to prisons. You adapt or you do not survive. But because of Red Alexander and what I observed, I knew that not only could I survive, but prosper. I felt I had to prosper, no matter the cost. If I was going to make it out at all, really, I figured that if I ever got out, I faced the very real possibility that I would be too old and disconnected from the free world to be anybody or accomplish anything with the rest of my life. One enters Texas prison the same way one comes into the world. Naked, scared, confused, and angry. The next stop on my journey was the diagnostic unit of the Texas Department of Corrections. To get there, one rides a bus, the chain. It's called that because occupants are chained inside. I'm the gay guy, so I am the first on the bus and therefore the last off the bus. When we get to Huntsville, it's late November, and there is sleet on the ground, and it is not wet melting. This is seriously cold weather for Texas. As I got off the bus, I was ordered to leave my clothes inside for their return trip to Harris County. Naked and barefoot, I ran 300 feet to the building, expecting to close the doors behind me. When I got there, I noticed the doors do not close. The hall I'm standing in is arranged north and south with the doors on the north end. That wind is coming directly from the North Pole with only a picket fence somewhere in Oklahoma to break it. With the temperature below freezing and the wind whistling between the cheeks of my pink ass, I was shivering and turning blue. And when you're the gay guy, it is considered day class A to crowd the guy in front of you from behind. So all I could do is freeze and hope to get to the end of that line as soon as possible. When I finally got there, at a school desk, sat a convict in short sleeves who seemed to be comfortable in the cold weather. To be this close to the door, he had to be what they call a trustee. Someone whom the prison administration trusts not to run off. In exchange for his service to the system, a trustee is given special authority and privileges. He looked up at me and said, "Raymond Wayne Hill." "Yes, 21-33-98. He only said it once. I'm buck naked. I have no way of writing down, but I knew that my identity was tied to that number, and if I ever forgot it, I may lose my identity forever. 21-33-98 is who I became that day, and to the officials of the great state of Texas, that is who I am still. From there, I was ushered into a room and ordered, press your nose against the wall and do not look around. I did that and had enough sense to figure out that as I moved down the wall to my left, that when another wall touched my shoulder, I would be expected to answer to the name next. I did and was put in a barber chair where they removed all of my hair, some of it by roots, much of it never grew back, with a very dull set of clippers. I was knocked stumbling out of that chair and directed into a large room filled with a steam cloud. Remember, it's very cold and the doors do not close, and I can hear water, presumably very hot water, running somewhere in that room. I carefully feel my way through the fog until I see an enormous man standing in the mists. He's 6'6", at least, stripped to the waist, his wet pants clinging to his thighs. There are rivulets of water running down his black, muscular, glistening chest. Across his chest is a wide, roven strap attached to a brass container more than 3 feet long and 15 inches in diameter. It has some kind of handle at the top, and a rubber hose extends out of the handle's base to his hand. He's gripping some kind of attached device out of which extends a copper tube more than 30 inches long. He looks at me and he smiles, showing snaggle teeth, and said, turn around, bend over, and spread your cheeks. You have no idea what I thought he was going to do with that copper tube. He then sprayed me head to foot with oil of camphor to kill any bugs I may have brought from Harris County Jail. So as my flesh fell away from the camphor, I waited for my turn to step into the scalding shower that would soon burn away the rest. Then I was issued my jumpsuit, and you know that routine. Little guys get to big sizes, and the big guys like me go hump-shouldered for a couple of weeks until we get a reissue. And so that was my introduction to the diagnostic unit of Texas prison. Diagnostic is like boot camp. They shout at you all the time, especially when you're eating or taking IQ tests or other unimportant things. Actually, they're checking you out to see what you can handle, what your breaking points are. But before I went to prison, I was teaching on a fellowship at a university. And one of my job assignments was giving standard IQ tests. So no matter, even the yelling and the hollering couldn't keep me from making a high score. On paper, anyway, I looked very impressive. And then the next thing they gave me was the manual dexterity test. I remember what Red Alexander told me about that. Don't do this. This is a cotton-picking test. You don't want to do this very well. You'll wind up working the line in the cotton fields. I knew he was probably right, but I also know that all intelligence grows out of hand-eye coordination. So against Red's advice, I bet that if I maxed out the cotton-picking test and the IQ test, I'd get a better job assignment from the shrinks who did the classification. I get done, and it's back out to the Sally Port, onto the chain, and off to the Ramsey unit just south of Houston. In fact, I won that bet. My job assignment wasn't in the line in the cotton fields, but as maintenance bookkeeper, an office job, an insider's job. You see, Texas prisons are agricultural operations, plantations, really. A very large percentage of rich river bottom land is tied up in prison plantation property. Prison compounds are located in the middle of prison cotton fields. The same land where slaves worked, Ramsey, is in Brazoria County, Texas, on the Texas coastal plain. Summers are oppressively hot. If you're in the line, you're in the cotton fields from daylight to dark, but the maintenance bookkeeper is an administrator working a few hours each day in an office. I got off the chain at the back gate at mid-morning. Everyone else who got off there was taken inside the compound for cell assignments, dormitory assignments, to be issued clothes and other welcoming activities. The officer at the back gate says to me, "Your name, Heel?" "Yes, sir," I replied. "Well, you go over there and wait under that tree. Sergeant Smith, maintenance, be over here to pick you up directly." And he left me there, under that tree, next to those fields. You've got to think about it. Look, I just got there from diagnostic after several months in the hellhole of Harris County Jail. I have a brand new 160-year sentence, and I'm outside the compound with no visible security watching. Thinking about it is a given. Right there is the corn, which is as high as I am tall, and next to that is Oyster Creek, and there's a path between the water and the embankment. You can see a long way across those fields. And then I noticed a little quiet cloud of dust on the horizon. As it got bigger, I saw it was a pickup truck and that the driver was not following the roadway, but driving across the fields and through the ditches like a maniac. He made the last turn around the compound fence, cut the steering, slammed on the brakes, and brought that truck into a four-wheel slide sideways within inches of my belly.
"Hill, get your ass in the back of the truck!"
I did, and held on for dear life as he tore back across the fields and ditches with the same enthusiasm with which he had arrived. When we got to the maintenance shack, the first thing I noticed was the air conditioner in the office window.
"What are you in here for?" Sergeant Smith demanded.
"Burglary."
"Well, it's high time they sent a burglar down here. I've been needing a damn burglar, so I want you to make me a set of lockpicks so I can break into a construction warehouse over there when nobody's around," he shouted.
Sergeant Smith always shouted. I worked closely with that man for years, and he never said anything in a normal tone of voice. Where does one get vocal cords like that?
"You make me a set of lockpicks at work, and you can work in this nice air-conditioned office. You fail, you'll be out there in them cotton fields working for Major Slim McGehee."
I had never actually seen a set of lockpicks. I had never picked a lock. See, I used bolt cutters when I was on the job, but in prison, no one ever admits to one's boss the limits of one's knowledge or abilities. After he left, I went around the maintenance shack, meeting the other convicts. "Do you know anything about lockpicks?" The only thing I learned is that three previous bookkeepers had indeed been transferred to the cotton fields when they failed to produce them. For the promise of a bag of coffee and some rolling tobacco, I got an inmate named Corbin to show me what a set of lockpicks looked like, although there was some doubt that he had ever seen any either. Corbin was an interesting case. His job was spray painter. On the outside, he was an urban drunk. When he ran out of money or luck, he'd get himself thrown into jail so that he could getting high on paint fumes at the state's expense. He shared his wisdom with me, such as it was. Now, there are two parts to lockpicks. One part is called the pressure bar, and the other part is called the tumbler blade. I made the pressure bar out of a large nail by bending the pointed end over in a vise and filing it flat on a grinder. For the tumbler blade, I cut a sliver off the back of a hacksaw blade. Oh, contrary to popular myth, prisons are full of hacksaw blades and files. You have to scrape them out of your way to find a place to sit down and eat lunch. Sergeant Smith had left me a desk full of padlocks to practice on, and I tried as best I could, but I could not open a single one. I was getting frustrated and worried when I heard the screech of the tires and the spray of the gravel on the side of the building. I had no time to rethink my design.
"Where's my lockpicks, Hill?"
I set them before him on his desk.
"They work?"
Well, Sergeant, if one wants to pick a lock, they'll do it. I might have to spend some time polishing them and to improve the way they work, but they're good as they are. As I tried to filibuster my way out of obvious failure, he opens three locks as fast as if he had the keys. So the theory of lock picks is not how they are made or designed. The real question is, how much larceny do you have in your heart? Within a month of my assignment as bookkeeper, a maintenance bookkeeper, the construction bookkeeper was caught pulling a young officer out of his ass in the back of a warehouse. I was asked to fill his job and my position for a couple of weeks, but I never gave that job back. As maintenance bookkeeper, I was in charge of all the lights, gas, water, sewage, job assignments, tool and part ordering on both the Ramsey units. And as construction bookkeeper, I planned, budgeted, staffed, even provided security for the work details on five other units in the southern district of the prison system. I was in charge of $1.5 million annual budget, and that's not considering the low ball figures for prison labor. I had my own international pickup and was free to go between any of those units unescorted as I felt the need to. I could go to Richmond or Rosenberg Angleton or the other small towns. It was a great situation, but I knew if I screwed up, the cotton fields were still waiting. Sometimes driving between units, I'd get stopped by the highway patrolman. "Let me see your driver's license." "I'm a convict. I don't have a driver's license." "I guess that means you won't be showing up in court either." "You got it. You can arrest me and put me in your jail. How's the food?" Because I had these jobs, all gates and doors open for me as I approached. Regular officers did not even give me instruction. Sergeant Smith and any of the captains, majors, and wardens were my bosses. I just never noticed when I would see Sergeant Smith in the warehouse at odd hours. I just juggled the books so that what he stole was reported lost or broken. As construction bookkeeper, I was in charge of inmates who were building and rebuilding the facilities that kept us. I always thought that was a great metaphor. In Texas, convicts build the cages that hold them. And my job was to make sure that got done right. You see, convicts do not escape because we have no means of doing so. Convicts stay because they want to. That's why there's hacksaw blades and files everywhere, and nobody's using them to escape. Tonight, on the Ramsey 1 unit, there are 1,600 convicts and 14 half-asleep guards. Those convicts do not have to stay. They stay because prison is where they live, where they choose to live. It beats the alternative for some, homeless and hungry. Or like Corbin, you just stay high till you die, no matter where you are. That wasn't how I was going to make it. I was going to make trustee. I was virtually a trustee because of my jobs. But official trustees were ritually recognized in prison society as having more status, and that meant that I could enjoy the freedom of movement that I had, and I could get 2-for-1 credit for the time I was serving. By becoming a trustee, my 160-year sentence would require only 80 years to complete. Such a deal! The only way one became trustee in those days was to be interviewed and approved trustee by Red McCaskill, Assistant Director for Classification. I had known Red and his brother Larry, who later became a Houston City Councilman, and their father, Red Sr., who was the constable of Precinct 1, since I was 5 or 6 years old. When I was a boy, the McCaskills would take me to the annual Coon Hunt fundraiser for High Sheriff Buster Kern. It was really just a drunken brawl through the woods, dogs barking, drunk hunters stumbling through the underbrush. And when I just couldn't keep up, one of the strong, young McCaskill boys would swing me up on his shoulders and take me to the end. Also, the warden at that time, and throughout most of my stay on the Ramsey, was Big Sid, Sidney Lanier, who knew my grandfather, Orsamus Hill. They had adjacent river bottom farms across the county line between Leon and Madison County.
All in all, I seemed to be in good shape to make trustee. A trustee who worked for the warden even told me it was a done deal. What I hadn't counted on was the role. The role is the ritual assertion of dominance in prison. It's about putting you in your place, in the pecking order. It's not about relationship. It's designed to shock you into submission. So the big day came, and I was ushered into the warden's office where Red McCaskill was interviewing potential trustees. Red sat at the warden's chair, leaning way back with his belly stretched to the limit, so he appeared to be as large as possible, big jaw tobacco, bright Texas afternoon sun from the window behind it made it so I couldn't see his eyes. He was playing the role, and I was expected to play along.
Oh, Keel, you ever think about punching it?
Yes, sir, Mr. McCaskill, I think about it every day.
Well, I hope to hell you got enough sense not to try it, because if you do, I'll come down here and kick you all up in your ass myself.
Red wasn't counting on our past. He was only testing me to see if I was. I kept myself extremely still.
Hill, I'm going to make your sorry ass a trustee against my better judgment anyway.
Thank you, Mr. McCaskill. I will not disappoint you, sir. I slowly backed out of the room and returned to my work. I had survived the role for now. I had made trustee, and I could do anything I wanted to. In construction, as long as it was a matter of inmate labor. Prisons use inmate muscle working in the hot summer sun to plant, grow, and harvest the crops. Field labor is divided into two parts. The garden squad, which tends the vegetables eaten by the inmates and the officers. The line works the cash crops like cotton, seed corn, and soybeans. That's where the money gets made. The King of Sweden has for many years bought Texas prison cotton for that country's textile industry. You can actually buy Texas prison cotton at IKEA. The garden squad works hard but fewer hours than the line. If you work in the line, you get up way before dawn, eat and go out the back gate as soon as there is enough light to see for the officers to see if any of you try to escape. You work all day, returning to the compound at nightfall. The drivers of each squad are inmates called leaderos, who push the other convicts at the command of officers. At the top of the power pyramid is field major. At the Ramsey, that was Major Slim McGeehee, riding at a distance with a rifle and a license to kill. From way before I came to the Ramsey, every black inmate had always been sent out in the line to pick cotton. To black inmates, work in the cotton fields was especially offensive. Besides being overseen by white armed guards on horseback the way their grandfathers and great-grandfathers were as slaves, if you were black, you were expected to produce 300 pounds of cotton a day. And if you didn't, Slim McGeehee's ability to make life miserable for you was limitless.
Nigger! Cut the hall tonight and see if you can learn to get me enough cotton tomorrow.
That meant you would be up all night long shelling peanuts, stingy goobers, getting burrs under your nails and tearing up your fingertips to fill a gallon bucket, and then you'd have to put in a full day of work trying to get 300 pounds of cotton, or you'd be up all night again. I caught the hole one time when Sergeant Smith thought I was got a little too uppity. And if it wasn't for Shorty Preston, I think I'd still be in that hall shucking them goobers. Shorty lived in the same unsegregated tank as me, and he knew I had soft bookkeeper's hands, so that night he came by, and first thing he turned the bucket over and beat the bottom convict so it wouldn't hold as much, and then he'd walk up and down the hall and grab a handful of goobers and shuck them in his pocket. He'd walk back and drop them in my bucket. Shorty Peston. Him and me and Jesse Shores. Now, Jesse's a big gal, 6'6", 300 pounds, gentle as a lamb. We were co-conspirators when it came to outsmarting sergeants and major and even a later warden. We were a strange team, kind of a queer mod squad. You had a big gal on one side, a little bit on the other, and me in the middle, and I was the wrong color. We did all our planning around a domino table in the wing. We figured out there just might be a way around old Slim. Slowly, over the course of a year, I started a new construction project requiring heavy labor that I was able to reassign 200 mostly large black men from the line to construction. I got Jesse out on his own tractor replacing 200-pound windmill motors from the top of a ladder. But that was like a vacation to him compared to the line. All of the inmates knew what we were doing, but we did it so gradually that old Slim didn't notice we were draining him dry until he showed up at the warden's office just before harvest time.
Big boss, I lost the goddamn many niggers to construction. I can't get the cotton in before it rains and gets wet and rots in the fields.
So on short notice, before it rotted in the rain, old Slim had to rent combines to bring in the cotton for the first time in Ramsey history. In those days, I wore a Mickey Mouse watch, so they called me Mickey. The morning those big harvesting machines rolled onto Ramsey, a cheer went up in every black wing on both units. The cheer was, "Old Mickey's outsmarted old Slim." There was an inmate on the Ramsey named Raper Dan. Raper Dan was a rapist. He was doing time for rape, and he continued to practice while in prison. He worked in the line. He was not very tall, but he had incredible strength. I considered hiring him for a job in maintenance once, but there was a concern that he might try to escape or rape a fellow worker. After being arrested, he had to be isolated in Harris County Jail for raping several other inmates. It even made the papers. On the Ramsey, rumor had it that Dan wanted a chance at Dolores. Dolores was a tall transvestite from Houston's Third Ward, where Dan was from. Nobody gave it much concern because ordinarily Dan and Dolores would never encounter each other. He worked in the line, and Dolores worked in the garden squad. Dan lived in the line cell block at one end of the main hall at Ramsey 1, while Dolores lived in the punk wing at the other end, with the other homosexuals in the dormitory. They never ate at the same time, neither attended school, nor were either of them repentant enough to go to church. One afternoon, about 2:45, the building major's bookkeeper called me and said, "Slim's bringing in the line." "Well, maybe he has a dental appointment," I suggested. "No. Someone else thought of that. We checked." "What do you think?" I inquired. "Smart money around here thinks Slim's going to give Dan his chance." Slim was bringing in the line was favorably timed to meet the garden squad at the back gate. What happens there is everyone in both groups takes off their clothes and wait naked in line to be shook down by the officers supervising them as they work. One at a time, each inmate steps forward to the officer at the head of each line, shakes his cap upside down, turns his socks wrong side out, lays those things aside, picks up his work boots, hits the heels together, turns, bends, spreads the cheek of his ass, showing the officer a large smile, picks up his stuff and heads for the showers. Ordinarily, the line workers would be held back until the garden squad had finished in the showers. Dan's chance, if he was going to take it, was while everyone was waiting naked in line to be shook down. By the time the line came in, everyone on the unit knew what was coming down, and everyone was there to watch it. The quality of one's view matched one's position in the pecking order. The building bookkeepers were gathered at the windows, but it wasn't just convicts. There were building majors and captains and low-ranking officers in every description gathered out in the yard. I had a bird's-eye view on top of the powerhouse with the boiler operators. Old Slim McGehee, still on his horse, rode down the fence just outside the compound to a position affording a good view of where Dolores was standing naked. Dolores seemed to be unaware that he was the object of all of this attention. He stood erect with his work boots discreetly held to cover his private parts, shifting his weight from foot to foot in a kind of rolling motion that seemed designed to provoke Dan's attention. Dan was way across the area, stretching his neck to see through all the other naked convicts. He was erect, too, but that's not in reference to his posture. Cocked and loaded may be a more descriptive term. Suddenly, Dan broke for it. He dropped his boots and began shoving his way across the maze of naked convicts, knocking those in the way down in the process. That caused a big commotion. Dolores to see what it was turned to see what it was all about. He saw Dan coming. He braced himself for the best defense, but to no avail. Dan was too strong, too motivated. He grabbed Dolores, turned him, bam, slam. They hit the ground. Everybody saw what they had come for. They let them alone for a few minutes. And on a signal from Slim, the officers inside the compound separated them. Both Dan and Dolores were covered in feces and blood, from the navel to the knees for Dan and down the backside for Dolores. They broke them up and carried them right over there to the solitary units. In those days, they were 3 by 3 by 6 foot red brick block boxes with metal doors. They thread you in there feet first so you could breathe through the little holes in the steel door. You stay in there without a shower, with 2 glasses of water and 2 slices of bread a day. And the Texas sun cooks on that red brick all day long. They were both charged with fighting without a weapon. Dan got 4 weeks in the box, but Dolores got 6 weeks. In prison, you were punished more severely for being the victim of rape than you are for being a rapist. We didn't think anything unusual about that, because being a passive victim is not tolerated in Texas prison. You know, it's a tragedy what Dan did to Dolores that day, and it's a tragedy what solitary did to both Dan and Dolores. Everybody could see that. But the other tragedy of that story, one that nobody could see but me, was what Ray Hill had become. I had placed several bets in different places for about $5 apiece that Dan would have meat in Dolores before they hit the ground. That was a good bet. I should have taken odds. I left that scene, went around, collected my money, and went back to work. I had been living at Ramsey 1 in the construction wing with the guys I worked with every day, but the food was better at Ramsey 2 than at Ramsey 1. There were no rocks in the beans or bugs in the greens, so I was moving to 2 Camp to get better food. And I could do that in those days. I was a maintenance and construction bookkeeper and a trustee. I could just come and go as I pleased. I just moved myself and let the major and the warden's bookkeepers know on each end, and it was done. Before my move, I upgraded the laboratory facilities at the Ramsey, 2 dormitories. I made sure that they had new sinks and plumbing and the lighting and new mirrors were installed. I moved into a new dormitory bunk in the back, nearest the toilets, because when you moved into a new dormitory, I don't care how important you were as a trustee, you're going to have to work your way forward by attrition. People would move on or go home, and you'd just move yourself forward as possible. So that night, I got a back bunk. And the next morning, I had a kind of epiphany. Those of you who did not grow up in church may find the term unfamiliar.
To Moses'